Yeah, good morning. Welcome back to Organizational Behavior, Organizational Psychology. I would like to mention two or three small things before we start. Next week, this applies only to the German students who want to go abroad. If you have any plans, any ideas, or if you just want to know about the opportunities, next week, Wednesday, 2 o'clock in Hartzett 8, you can attend this session where the international office will provide information about study programs, partner universities, opportunities for funding, etc. So those of you who are thinking of going abroad should attend this session. And then I would like to remind you of the Wissenschaftspraxis Colloquium. There will be four talks this semester. Next week, 25th of November, Joachim Krüger, Brown University. Joachim Krüger will talk in English about different variations of trust and how we can measure and examine them in the laboratory and in the field. These will all be at 6:30 p.m. in HZ10. Over in the big lecture center. And then on the 9th of December, Manuel Völkel from the Max Planck Institute in Berlin will talk about analyzing longitudinal data. But he, I think, will talk about in German. We'll talk in German. On the 27th of January, Dirk Frank, who is head of the Institute for Market Research, Social Institute of Social and Market Research in Bad Homburg. We recently visited him with the alumni, and I think he does very interesting things, and he's also open for students who would like to do internships, for example. And then finally for this semester, Bertolt Meyer from the University of Chemnitz on 10th of February will talk about diversity, what we know about diversity. All talks except the first one are in German, I think, but this one next week would also be open and hopefully interesting for international students. Okay, then I would like to show you a little video before we start with today's lecture. It's a video by or of Viktor Frankl. Who knows Viktor Frankl? Who has heard about Frankl before? Frankl was a survivor of the concentration camps of the Nazis. All his family was killed in concentration camps. And still, as a relatively young man in the 1940s, he didn't despair, but he looked for meaning in his life. And from then on, or from there on, he developed logotherapy, the therapy that works with clients who have suffered severe traumata, and he kind of heals them or gets them into the healing process by, together with the client, working towards finding meaning in life. And this video is a little, and I met Viktor Frankl when he was 90 in 1994. He was almost blind and of course a very old man, but he was still charismatic. He was a very interesting, wonderful person, and you will see in a moment from a talk that he gave at Harvard University in the 1960s that he is also a very humorous, funny person. So this is about the meaning of life and what motivates people, and I think this nicely fits to the discussion of our topic today.
They wish to make a lot of money. In Europe, every American student, if more, every American adult is regarded as someone who is just out to make a lot of money. Really, what, 16% of these students regarded their main goal and concern in life to make a lot of money. I'm quoting literally, make a lot of money. And you know what the top class, the top category? We say category, what do you say? Category was among, you excuse me, but I know I am speaking a marvelous accent without the slightest English. Now, the You know what the top category was? 78% of these American youngsters were concerned, as they expressed it themselves, with finding a meaning and purpose in their lives. So this is a realistic view on man. And you know, you won't believe it, gray hair, my age, I started taking flying lessons recently. Do you know what my flying instructor told me? If you are starting here, wish to get here, say east, heading for this, and you have a crosswind, you will drift and you will land here. So you have to do what we pilots call crabbing, he told me, C-R-A-B, crabbing. You have to head for north of this airfield, and you have to fly that way, you see, as if you headed in this direction. If you are heading here above this airfield, then you will actually land here. But if you head for here, you are landing here. This holds also for man, I would say. If we take man as he really is, we make him worse. But if we overestimate him, it's premature, your applause, you will soon know why. If we seem to be idealists and are overestimating, overrating man, and looking at him that high, here above, you know what happens? We promote him to what he really can be. So we have to be idealists in a way, because then we wind up as the true, the real realists. And you know who has said this? If we take man as he is, we make him worse. But if we take man as he should be, we make him capable of becoming what he can be. This was not my flight instructor, this was not me, this was Goethe. He said this verbally. And now you will understand why I, in one of my writings, once said, this is the most apt maxim and motto for any psychotherapeutic activity. So if...
Okay, we are not here for psychotherapeutic activities, but I think this is a very nice saying that looking into the people's potential can motivate people. And Frankl started with a survey that he or someone else has done among students, and apparently only few students make it their prime goal in life to make a lot of money. Most students, and I hope some of them are among you, most students want to pursue their potential, want to do something meaningful, want to do something more than just earning a living. Although making money is not a bad thing in itself, but it has to do with different motivations that we follow. And we will talk about leadership also today a little bit, because motivation is also a factor that leaders need to consider. And when we only see people as what they already are, or then we probably indeed make them worse, but we have to understand our people's drives and motives, and we have to believe that people are capable of more than what they are doing currently or at the moment. Last week's questions. Last week we talked about perception biases, we talked about the hidden profile, we talked about errors that we make. I told you about the Himalaya experience or the Everest experience, where several people got killed because of some of these biases, like the sunk cost effect or the recency effect. And I hope that I've also been able to show you how these affect things at the workplace. What is the process by which individuals organize and interpret their sensory impressions in order to give meaning to their environment. Is it social verification, environmental analysis, emotional labor, perception, or cognitive dissonance? Moritz?
Perception.
Correct. Thank you. Which of the following terms, and that was simple. Oh, Moritz, was easy. Yeah. And so is the exam. Very easy, very simple. And you can bring all your slides. No bulimic learning necessary. Which of the following terms best describes the tendency to underestimate the influence of external factors and overestimate the influence of internal factors when making judgments about the behavior of others? Selective perception, emotional dissonance, framing effects, bandwagon effects, or the fundamental attribution error? Dankeschön. Thank you. Because it is impossible for us to assimilate everything we see, we engage in cognitive dissonance, a fundamental attribution error, emotional labor, selective perception, or the self-serving bias. Selective perception. We constantly select the information that stream into our sensory system because otherwise we would not be capable of doing anything. And so we concentrate on the things that we need to know, and some of this happens unconsciously or implicitly or subtly, and some of it happens consciously, and we filter out the information that we need in an active and conscious way. But a lot of it is implicit and then also leads to the biases that we discussed. Any remaining questions from last week or general questions? Then let's talk about motivation today. In a way, it's a final session of the individual parts of this lecture, and then from next week on, we move into the group and social part of this lecture when talking about groups, teams, communication, and leadership. But of course, as I said, motivation has also a lot to do with leaders and how leaders perceive the world and perceive individuals. And also put yourself in the shoes of a leader today when we talk about the motivation theories, because I think understanding and knowing about these theories helps managers making better decisions at work. So at the end of the lecture, and it's two chapters in the Robbins and Judge textbook today that I combined into one lecture. So the slides at the start and the slides at the end of today capture both the summaries of the two chapters. So today we describe the three key elements of motivation. Then we talk about early theories and more recent theories of motivation, such as goal setting, organizational justice, or expectancy theory. We will talk a little bit about the cultural boundness of motivation theories. And then we go to more applied motivation theories and concepts such as the job characteristics model, job design and redesign, employee involvement practices, and motivational benefits of intrinsic rewards. Let's start with defining motivation. What is motivation? What do we mean when we say or think that someone is highly motivated or not so motivated? Typically, it's three aspects. It's the individual's intensity, direction, and persistence of effort towards attaining an organizational goal. And many people start off with a high intensity of doing something. You all did this in your bachelor program when you started studying. You all continued doing this now in your master's program. There's always hectic activity at the beginning of these courses. You get all the textbooks and new notes and pencils and everything. It doesn't lead anywhere when we don't know about the direction. And motivation is also about the right channeling of our effort into the right direction, which for most employees, it's a linkage to the organization's goals, and for you, it's the goals of your studies. So what do you want to do with your master's degree after you finish in 1.5 years? And then you have to make the right decisions where you put the greatest intensity on and when to concentrate on which areas and aspects. And finally, it's about persistence. People who are highly motivated are typically also persistent. How long maintain they their effort, particularly when there are obstacles, problems, hurdles, and people who are highly motivated maintain their level of effort even when these problems occur or arise. Okay, so this is a simple definition of motivation, but it's important to consider these three different aspects. And then let's talk about early theories of motivation. Several of these theories have not been validated or at least been not completely supported by research, but it's still good to know about these theories. First, because they can still guide our thinking about motivation when we practice motivation theories in organizations, and I'll show you some examples or tell you about some examples in a moment. And secondly, because these theories are still applied in practice. So practicing managers still talk about Maslow, McGregor, Hertzberg, or McClelland, and they may talk about some of the more recent theories that we discuss in a moment, such as goal setting theory, which now is around for also more than 40 years. But in terms of getting into the mainstream literature, it's a more recent theory. And some managers, of course, or many managers, know goal setting theory, but probably not some of the even more recent ones, but they will still know about these theories. So it's good that you know about the theories, scope, aim, range, but also about its limitations. So we go through these one by one. Let's start with Maslow's hierarchy of need theory. Maslow came up with his five-step model, or the triangle of motivation, and he said on the basis there's a physiological level of needs. This is the basic fundamental needs of all human beings for food, for drink, for sleep, for sex. The key physiological things that drive our behavior. And these should be satisfied before we can move on to higher levels of motivation. If we are hungry, then we are not so motivated by getting social approval. If we are not having enough to drink, we care less about safety. This applies to humans, but this applies to the workplace in particular. So in the workplace, you can think about physiological needs about getting a minimum pay. So the current debate about minimum wages in Germany and other countries essentially is a debate about satisfying people's physiological needs. Do people earn enough to afford a living from their daily work? When you work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, then you should earn enough to pay your rent, to buy your food, to get enough clothing, etc. So these are the physiological needs that managers should care for when they determine minimum pay in their organizations, for example. And Maslow proposed this hierarchy of needs, and his suggestion was, or his proposals were, that every need needs to be satisfied before people start being motivated by the higher order or the next higher order need. So this is a part that has not been confirmed by research. People seem to be more motivated by several of these needs simultaneously, and in some situations, some needs can be salient and become more important than other needs. For example, workplace safety. This is what we're talking about when we talk about health and safety issues at work. So some people, of course, are more at risk, those who work in land mining disposal or those who work in the heavy construction industry. And for them, workplace safety is, of course, a slightly larger or more important issue than it typically is in a university. But if you would work in the Department of Chemistry, for example, health and safety instructions are also very important. And in general, they are more important than your physiological needs. But again, when you're very hungry or extremely thirsty or when you haven't slept for a long time, then you pay less attention, and it's probably less important for you personally that health and safety procedures are maintained or kept. And these two, the physiological and safety needs together, are the lower order needs. And then Maslow proposed three higher order or upper needs, social, esteem, and self-actualization needs that really motivate people. And in a moment, we will be talking about Hertzberg. Hertzberg proposed a dichotomy between hygiene factors and motivating factors. And probably this is what Hertzberg, this resembles Hertzberg's hygiene factors, and this is what really motivates people. Getting social approval, working in a harmonious atmosphere, working not in isolated conditions and alone in small cubicles, but together in teams. We all have a need for positive self-esteem. All the time we try to think and feel good about ourselves by doing good things. And this need can be met and satisfied by getting interesting work that we are happy about, that we are capable of, that we perform on a high level, and that would feed back into our self-esteem. And self-actualization is every human's, according to the theory of Maslow and Rogers and others, self-actualization is the highest need that we can strive for, and that leaders, teachers, parents should give everyone they lead or educate an opportunity for. And this is what Frankl meant. Self-actualization. Allow people to become what they can become ideally. Allow them to utilize their full potential. Do not give them always routine work. Challenge them and let them do what they are good at and let them become better at what they are already good at. Okay, and as I said, this theory has not completely been confirmed by research, particularly the structure has not been confirmed. It's not necessarily a pyramid that the higher order needs are more important than the lower order needs and that they need to follow a stage model. This has not been confirmed by research, but as I said, it's still around in practice and it's still a good guidance to think about what may be important for the people I lead at the moment. And to think a little bit more widely than many managers do and only think about money. So it's various things that we should attend to as managers above and beyond paying our employees well. The next classic or traditional theory was developed by Douglas MacGregor in the 1960s. He suggested that all managers have a duality of a worldview. Some managers think theory X, and some, much fewer managers, think in a theory Y mindset. Theory X mindset leaders or managers think that all people have an inherent dislike for work. People do not like to work. And they will attempt to avoid work if they can. So what we need to do is we have to force them into work, we have to control them, we have to threaten them with punishment if they don't do what management says. And this has not only been the dominating view at MacGregor's time 50 years ago, but it is still a dominant view of modern day managers. Managers probably, maybe not at university where you work with PhD students and master students, etc. But managers in traditional service or manufacturing industry often still think that people only come to work because they are paid for it and that they will avoid to do work when they are not controlled. This was a dominant view and maybe still is a dominant view. And in economic models, we talked about rational decision-making models last week, and in economic models, this is the best way to behave. If I want to maximize my outcome, I take the payment, I take the salary that I get, and I do as little as possible to receive it. However, people are probably motivated by different things, and not only by money, and people are probably not inherently lazy. And this is reflected by people who hold a theory Y mindset. They view work as being natural as rest or play. And we want to do work because it's natural. We want to do something. We feel bad if we don't have anything to do for a longer time. And therefore, employees exercise self-direction and self-control once we are committed to the objectives of our work. Once we think that our work is meaningful and that the organization's goals and objectives are meaningful to us, then we exert motivation in terms of self-control and we are committed to fulfilling these goals. And in economics, this only recently has pulled a cord or a string. And Nobel Prize winner George Akerlof, I don't know, when was that? 2010, so 4 years ago, he wrote this book about identity economics. And Akerlof published two or three papers in the top economic journals, American Economic Review and so on, where he says that the old model of controlling employees is a very costly model. And what does it signal in the first place? What do we signal to our people when we control and monitor them? For example, by making them pushing their cards into a machine every morning when they go to work and stamping the card again when they leave work. What do we signal when we control and monitor our people's behavior? Distrust or mistrust, yes. We say if we control you by having you pulling a card into a machine every morning, we don't trust that you would report to work when it is necessary or when it is typical or whatever. Within the organization's norms and goals, we don't trust that you will do the right things. And Akerlof says that this is costly. This is extremely costly. We have to pay the money for the control instrumentarium. We have to have more and more managers who do nothing else than controlling and monitoring their people and having regular appointments and appraisals with them for maintaining the control that it is that is necessary. And he presents an alternative model which he calls identity economics, and he says what we really should do as managers is make people commit to our objectives, make them identify with the organization and its members and its goals, because then people will do the right thing, because being a member of the organization, being part of the organization, reflects positively back to them and their own self-esteem. So it's an old model in a way, because, as I said, McGregor has published his model in 1967, so it's around for quite a long time, but only very recently it has been picked up by mainstream economic thinking. Akerlof didn't win the Nobel Prize for this book. He won the Nobel Prize in 2001 or 2, I think, but it's still good to have a Nobel Prize winner picking up on these social psychological ideas and making it known in the economic literature. Very quickly, Bill Uchi, a Japanese management scholar, he developed 20 years after or 15 years after McGregor, he developed a third theoretical mindset theory, Z, which is about the Japanese management style. And the Japanese management style in the 1970s and 80s was considered extremely successful. So the Japanese car manufacturers, for example, could produce cheaper cars than the standard US automotive companies could do at that time. And they were still reliable and good cars that could be sold for far less money than Chrysler and Ford and other American cars. So the Japanese management style is about developing close bonds between organization and its employees. It's providing employment for a lifetime. It's taking care about the employee's well-being and welfare. It's almost about creating a family. And I would not see this uncritically. At that time, it was something new and it was something different than the typical US-American approach to management. And I think since then, a lot has happened. We will be talking about the Hawthorne studies in next week. A lot has happened in the area of creating teams, creating a positive atmosphere, doing something for people to identify with and commit with. but you also know about the stories about people in Japan killing themselves because they are so overworked and so focused on work only, and also some other negative things. So I'm not idealizing the Japanese management style, but Uchi was right in saying we don't only have theory X and theory Y, there are other things. We should look beyond the American or standard European system of managing people. Okay, now I have a little exercise for you, a team exercise. So I would like you to group among I would like you to complete this questionnaire first individually and then sit together with groups of three or four students and discuss the results. So on the first page you have a little questionnaire, fill it out for yourself and then get together with groups of three or four people and do the analysis for yourself and then discuss it with your partners. It's about the Hertzberg model that we will then discuss in more detail.
bei Ihnen sehr ähnlich?
Ja.
Hm? Ja.
Das ist überhaupt sehr hoch insgesamt, würde ich sagen.
Das klingt halt ja auch alles positiv. Das sind ja jetzt alles Sachen, wo man sagt, das will ich überhaupt nicht. Ne? Ja. Aber wie wäre denn das Maximum? Wäre 30, glaube ich, ne, bei beiden. Ja, und Sie sind ziemlich stark am Maximum. Sie wollen also alles und zwar alles ganz stark. Und bei Ihnen, was haben Sie?
Ich habe 26.
Ja, bei Ihnen ist in der Mitte und bei Ihnen ist jetzt von Ihnen dreien etwas weniger.
Ja, dann richtig.
What did you get? 24, 28, 21, 25?
So relatively high, relatively close to each other. What did you get? Hmm? Yeah, so. Moritz, Geld ist für dich nicht wichtig, oder? Geld ist nicht wichtig.
Nee,
gut. Merke ich mir.
Okay, thank you very much. I think it's always good to get to know yourself a little bit better, and by this understanding the material and the series a little bit better. I just did a very quick check, and there are no cultural differences. So our students from China have about the same scores than the German students have. And all of you have relatively high scores and relatively scores that are relatively close to each other in both dimensions, the hygiene and motivating factors. And I think this probably reflects that you are all extremely well educated. So you can afford saying, yeah, I would like to have it all if possible. And why should we not have a good boss? Why should someone say, I don't want this? If you were forced to exchange a good boss by more pay or an interesting job by less job security, then it's probably a little bit more tricky and more difficult to decide. Our colleagues from the economics department have recently surveyed their final year students, with a list of potential things to look at in the jobs they are going to apply, and they used a forced ranking. So they should give their first priority, second priority. And when you do that, then it becomes a little bit more tricky and more difficult. Yes, please. I'm pretty sure that work experience helps us getting to know what is more important a little bit more, but I don't know about a study in the area of Hertzberg that has shown that work experience changes being more focused on the hygiene rather than the motivating factors or vice versa. I don't think that there are studies. Yes, please. On Hertzberg. Of course, when you are responsible for others, then you probably endure bad work a little longer because you know the paycheck is needed to pay the rent and the food for your children or so. Yeah, clearly, definitely. But the fact that you have relatively high scores on all these dimensions reflects that you are all well educated, and then that you probably compared to a representative sample of 20 23, 24-year-old people, you will probably end up in jobs that provide you with both more interesting things on the one hand and also more of the hygiene factors. So this came, Herzberg was dissatisfied with the traditional view on job satisfaction. The traditional view on job satisfaction is that we have a continuum, one dimension, and we can either be dissatisfied or happy with our job. And Herzberg questioned people about the things that made them feeling good and satisfied when they were at work and experiences that make them feel unhappy and dissatisfied at work. And then he found that people reported completely different things. Some people are reporting things on the hygiene factor side, and you can be dissatisfied or satisfied with these hygiene factors. But being satisfied with your hygiene factors or not being dissatisfied with one's job does not necessarily mean that we are happy in our jobs. And Herzberg found that happiness stems from the motivating factors. And this means we have to break up this unidimensional continuum into two factors, and we can be high or low on both factors. And according to Herzberg, people think about the quality of supervision, having a good boss, about the pay, about physical conditions, company policies, job security, when they mention things that make them unhappy at their work. So managers should do everything they can to maintain hygiene factors high. So going back to Maslow, we should make sure that people can afford a basic living and that job security is provided. But when we do that, it's not sure or it's not necessarily the case that people are happy. They are only not dissatisfied. To motivate people and to make them happy, according to Herzberg, managers should focus on the motivating factors. Provide people the opportunity to being promoted, to grow, and not because of material benefits or having another job title, but grow and develop in the workplace, extend the range of responsibility and autonomy that typically comes with entering higher levels of the hierarchy. Opportunities for personal growth. Develop in what you are doing, do more challenging things to find out what you are good at and to progress, gaining recognition from others, having responsibility, being able to achieve on a high level. This model has also been heavily criticized. Some people have said Herzberg only found the two factors because he asked two different questions. And this is just a methodological necessity of factor analysis revealing two different factors when we ask two different questions. There is some research that has confirmed that there is such a methodological bias, some research that has confirmed Herzberg's original proposition or original thinking. And I think it's good to think again that there are more than just some factors, but that we have a huge variety of factors and that we should, as managers, try to satisfy as many as we can and also use this as a basis, or use Maslow as a basis, to find out what really motivates your individual members of your team or department. Typically, when we think about a new project and when we think about managers think about who could I assign this project and what could I promise as a reward, people, typical managers, think of money, think of extra vacation time, maybe think of promotion opportunities in the distant future. And managers hardly think beyond this, but people tick very differently. It depends, for example, whether you are responsible for other people or not, that you probably focus a little bit more on pay than others. So for some people in your group, pay may be the most important thing. I know this from our student research assistants. We have constantly, we have like 4, 5, 6 different student research assistants, and I know that for some of them, money is the most important thing because they need to completely finance their studies for themselves. For others, the money is not the core issue. It's also important, but not the core issue because they have relatively wealthy parents who support them. So for them, it's much more important to get recognition, to do a job in which they can have some responsibility about what they are doing, and these things. And for yet other students, it might be that they're interested in opportunities for personal growth or promotional opportunities, particularly research assistants in the end of the master program who think about, oh, maybe I could do a PhD afterwards. And then they're interested in doing different things in their job than just doing copies and standing at the copy machine all day. And for those who are only or mainly interested in pay, it may be a different story. So I think although research has not completely confirmed the theory, it's still a good method to think a little bit more widely about what might motivate the people that I manage. A theory that has largely been confirmed by research is McLellan's theory of needs. And it's still used and still active also in personality psychology, in work and organizational psychology. And there are scales to measure the three different needs: need for achievement, need for power, need for affiliation. And it seems that many people have a dominant motive in one of the three dimensions, but we can also be high on all three motives or low on all three motives. But most people seem to be driven by one or two of them. So for some people, it's need for affiliation, the desire to have harmonious and positive relationships at work. And people who have a high need for affiliation, of course, are more satisfied and happy in jobs that are team-based, and where you have constantly interactions with other people, and when these other people do not change all the time but are relatively stable and homogeneous. For other people, need for power is a dominating or dominant motive. Power, briefly defined, we talk about power in 4 weeks in a lot more detail. The need to make others behave in a way that these others would not normally do. And for some people, this need for power is relatively high. The problem in German is that power or Macht sounds so negatively. And therefore, people try to avoid saying, yes, I have a high need for power. But I'm relatively sure that many of you will have some power later on in your work, because you, after your studies, will also lead people. You will be managing other people, and you also have power when you are a psychotherapist, for example, about your client. You constantly make your client behave in ways that they would not normally behave out of a good reason. So your need for power may be a good need in this relationship, because you have to do that for a good end goal or end state. Think about the values that we discussed last week, and terminal values and the other ones. What were the other ones? Terminal values and... Could someone help me? The others. Need for achievement, the drive to excel, to be good at something that we do and become better and better over time. And sometimes also the drive to win against others and compete against others and come out as the best. And we vary in these needs. So how are these needs related to job performance or satisfaction at jobs? High achievers prefer jobs with personal responsibility, where they get feedback from others, but also from the job itself, and where some intermediate degree of risk. So they like some risk, but because they also have this high need to be good, they avoid situations with large risk involved, where the likelihood of failure or not meeting the goals is higher than the likelihood of meeting the goals. High achievers are not necessarily good managers. I don't know theoretically why this is the case, but empirically it has been shown that people who are extremely high on the need for achievement are good job performers, but do not necessarily become good managers or leaders. Whereas a high need for power and a relatively low need for affiliation seems to be a good combination to managerial success. So people with a high need for power and a relatively low need for affiliation are more likely than others to end up in powerful positions. Whether they are good leaders or not is a different question or different story. Okay, so this was basically all the classic theories that I think you should at least have heard about and know that they are around. And now we are talking about more recent contemporary theories of motivation. We start with self-determination theory, discuss goal setting a little bit, self-efficacy, only very sketchy, and then equity and expectancy theory. Self-determination theory also was developed in the 1980s, early 1990s, by DC and Ryan, and it's one of the probably at the moment most prominent theories in organizational behavior, very widely used in many research projects, and you find it in publications. It's in principle a relatively simple theory. People prefer to have control over their actions. And when we feel that we are forced to do something, our motivation will decrease. So when we are intrinsically motivated to do something because we like the type of work or we find it meaningful or we find it significant and important, then forcing people to do this by extrinsic rewards or threats of punishment can reduce our intrinsic motivation. And one example that comes out of the general self-determination theory is cognitive evaluation theory. And I think I've already mentioned this either here or in social psychology. This goes back to the classic studies by Kurt Lewin in the 1940s, who has done his research with children, and when you invite children to the laboratory and give them all possible toys to play with, and among them are colorful crayons and good paper, then they like drawing with these papers. And then in one condition, they rewarded the children with money for making good drawings. And this made these children's not be interested in the cranes anymore when they were re-invited to the laboratory a couple of weeks later and when the reward was taken away. So they were the money focused them on the goal of getting the money and reduce the intrinsic satisfaction that it causes normally children to draw and play with crayons. And this is often mistakenly seen as a guideline for managers that pay is not so important, so you don't have to pay your people. It can even destroy their intrinsic motivation. This is, of course, not what cognitive evaluation theory is about. This is also not what Levine's classic study was about. But as managers, we should think, particularly when we implement bonus systems, we may think about negative implications this may have. And probably we also think about getting other rewards that are important for people, such as showing recognition and paying attention to what people do and verbally rewarding them. This, again, might be understood by some managers as words can heal everything and can overcome the problems with low pay. But, of course, this is not how it is intended. And going back to Maslow again, we should satisfy people's needs. And people's needs are different. Some need more money, some people are happy with a little bit less money. But we should satisfy their needs. And from then on, from there on, from a certain level on, we should more carefully think about how we reward people. And one theory that we can use is goal setting theory. And goal setting theory is one of the best supported theories by research. Several hundred studies have shown that setting difficult but specific goals or specific and difficult goals will increase people's performance. The meta-analysis have shown medium to large effect sizes, and there are only few studies that have found negative or null effects. So overall, you cannot do anything wrong by setting specific and difficult goals. You will end up with higher performance. However, there are a few conditions that we should consider. The difficult goals need to be accepted by employees. When you as a manager set a difficult goal and it is not accepted by employees because they think it's too difficult or it will cost them extra time or risks that they are not willing to go or so, then it will probably not work. Goal setting should be accompanied by feedback. If I set a goal and then never measure how far we are in the process of attaining the goal and feeding this back and never giving any feedback on at the end of whether the goal was attained or not, then over time goal setting may lose or will lose its positive impact. There are some contingencies also. In the Western culture, goal setting seems to work a little bit better than in Eastern cultures. I don't understand this. And goal commitment, this is interesting. Do you think it's better to make your goal public or keep your goal to yourself? Who thinks it's better to make your goal public and tell others about it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Who thinks it's better to keep them for yourself? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, some are not yet decided. In general, there's a lot of research that has found that it's good to make your goals public. It's good to tell others what you are trying to achieve. However, only as long as you make it very specific what you want to do and which steps are necessary to attain these goals, and get others then to monitor your behavior and, if possible, to support you in attaining the goal. Gollwitzer, a psychologist at Konstanz and New York University, did some research in the last years where he had students and also other people reveal their goals, and either they kept their goals to themselves, so they had to write down their goal and then keep the piece of paper to themselves to be reminded of their goal at a later stage, or they had to give their goal to a researcher or other people. And what Gollwitzer found was that people who reveal their goals to other people invest less time in attaining the goals. So I think the first experiment that he had done was with law students, and these law students were invited to the laboratory, they were told about several psychological theories, and then they had to fill in a questionnaire, and at the end of the questionnaire, Gollwitzer was asking them about their goals to become successful students and end up with a good grade in their classes. And afterwards, they had the opportunity to study material that would help them doing the next exam well. And he found that half of the students that were asked to tell the experimenters their goal were investing much less time to study, whereas the other half was investing more time. And his explanation is, once we make our goal public to others, it feels like we are already halfway there. When I think I would like to do more sports and I will run a marathon next year, and I tell this many people, then I feel good about myself. I already feel like having a half marathon getting out of my way. I'm almost there. If I make my goal public, then I should say, and to achieve my goal of running a marathon in a year from now, I will practice 3 days a week, and my goal is to run 10 kilometers more every month between now and March. And I have to tell these people who can monitor whether I actually do what I promise or not. If I just tell these people who never see me running, then it will also not do the trick. So that's why I put the exclamation and the question mark there. In general, it's good to tell it others, because this makes your commitment to the goal becoming stronger. But you have to find a clever way of how you do this. This is goal-setting theory in graphic form and in a nutshell. Difficult and specific goals lead to higher performance. Why? Because of these mediating factors that have all been confirmed and supported by research. The specific goal make us putting in more effort, being persistent, and help us also with the attention and planning phase. We pay attention to the goals that we have committed ourselves to and ignore other things that are distracting. When we formulate goal setting in a good manner, it also helps with performance because it makes ourselves already feel more confident that we actually meet the goals. And I will show you how this works in a moment. However, not every difficult and specific goal leads to a more positive outcome. People need to have the right abilities. When I, as a manager, set a difficult goal that I'm convinced I could attain, then probably I have not understood that probably not every one of my employees has the same abilities and skills than I have. It depends on people's personality. Some people have a personality that they don't like others setting goals for them, for example. Or some people find goals more important that have to do with their being more or less conscientious. When there's no feedback, when there's no goal commitment, then it's more difficult to translate difficult goals into higher performance. Have you heard about the SMART principles of setting goals? Some of you not. I have to find my notes. It's interesting. SMART. So the SMART principles help you as group leaders or managers, and also you yourself when you want to use goal setting theory to make plans for the next 6 months and what you want to achieve and how you would like to perform, then you could of course also use goal setting theory for yourself. And the SMART principles help us a little bit with getting the moderating factors right and with focusing on some of the mediators. And the interesting thing is when you Google the SMART principles, you find hundreds if not thousands of entries. And many of them are just outright bullshit, are completely crap. For example, the S is specific. Specific goals. When you Google the SMART principles, you often find the first S stands for simple. No, that's not the case. It's definitely not the case. Goals need to be difficult, not simple. Goals need to be specific. Second one is measurable. 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 If you cannot measure how far you are on the goal setting, then you cannot provide any feedback. And then people are not motivated or much less motivated to follow the goal than if you make it measurable and can provide feedback. Accepted. I already mentioned this. Relevant. And time-bound. Time-bound means there should be a start and an end, and ideally some sub-goals on the way to this end. So don't say, oh, we want to become the best team in the world. Great goal, probably a difficult goal, but difficult to measure, probably not accepted. Relevant only when all team members agree that being great is something that they find relevant for their daily work. And it's clearly not time-bound. There's no end to it. When will we determine whether we are already great or not? Okay? So the SMART principles are extremely useful, but please make sure that you use these SMART principles and not something you'll find on some consultants' web pages. Management by objectives is closely related to goal-setting theory. Ah, and one other thing. Goal-setting has also very negative side effects. Goal-setting works. It makes people focusing on the goals, and because of the mediators, it makes them pay attention to what the goal is about and what is necessary to achieve the goal. And this is a key problem of the goal-setting process. It often has very negative side effects that we, A, don't pay attention to things that are also needed and also necessary. Sometimes goal-setting can make us so focused that we forget everything around us. And sometimes we only follow the things and only do the things that make us earn more money because we succeed in attaining the goal, and we forget that there are other people around, or that the organization has also other missions, other ideas, other values. And sometimes it can even lead to unethical behavior, because we are so focused on getting the goal, we are fiddling the numbers, or we are trying to get as much money in, and we don't care for the customer's needs, etc. So some people have seen goal setting as the root of the financial crisis problem, or the scandals of Enron and similar companies, where managers have seriously fiddled the numbers and made deliberate errors and mistakes because they were so focused on the things that were formulated according to goal setting theory that were related to their bonuses. Yes, please. It's both. I think people can have the wrong goals, and when goal setting is aligned with the wrong goals of the individuals, when, for example, making most money is the number one goal of the people in the industry or in the organization, and you set goal setting in a way that you say, the difficult goal is that every one of us would get 50 more customers in the next 3 months, no matter what you sell them. Then, of course, most people will perform because the performance will help them attaining their goal of making as much money as possible. But ultimately, the 50 new customers that are attracted to the organization for the short-term goal of getting more customers will not be happy customers, because some of them or many of them are sold things that they never need. And then you have a problem. But it's not the goal-setting theory. The goal-setting itself still works. Yeah. But we have to think about this as managers. We have to think about these potential side effects. And One theory, although it's more like a bunch of suggestions, is management by objectives, or MBO. This converts the overall organizational objectives into more specific objectives for teams, departments, and then ultimately individuals. So it's about elements of the goal-setting process. It makes the wider goals more specific. It makes time periods more explicit. It provides feedback. And to get the goals or the management by objective system more accepted, we have people participate in the decision-making process. So sometimes you will find management by objectives as a management theory, and you, when you are in some organization, you will hear, yeah, we are doing management by objectives. In principle, they are doing nothing else than implementing goal-setting theory's principles. Relatively quickly, self-efficacy theory, the individuals believe that they can perform a task, that they have the necessary skills, that they have the necessary abilities, and that they feel confident to overcome problems, hurdles, and you see that this is increased by people who have an active mastery. You can, by gaining more experience, you gain a feeling that you can master the problems. By looking for others who are performing the job already well, and then using them as role models, When someone convinces you that you have the skill, when a supervisor has trust in you and tells you that he thinks that you are capable of doing this, this increases your own self-efficacy. And when we are energized, and this is why missions of organizations are so important. Missions energize people when they are formulated in the right way. There's this, this famous statement, I think it's also on video on YouTube somewhere. President Kennedy in 1961, I think, set the goal that the United States would land a man on the moon within the decade. And I think the United States invested something like $10 billion on attaining this goal. So it was a huge goal that people at the start of the 1960s were not all sure about that they could attain it. But it energized the people at NASA. It energized the people, also the general public. We Americans want to land a man on the moon. And then Kennedy was, I don't know, in Florida or California in one of the NASA factories, and he saw a man sweeping the floor. And then he was approaching the man and asking the man, what are you doing here? What is your job? And this man thinks, Mr. President, I'm helping to land a man on the moon. So no matter how simple your task may be within the organization, the mission can help to feel energized, and the resulting arousal helps us also to have a higher level of self-efficacy. Okay? Next theory. Many theories today. Equity theory. I think we've covered this in basic social psychology also a little bit. Equity theory is basically nothing more than you very carefully monitor what you receive from a relationship with your intimate partner, in your family, with the people you live with as a student, and of course also the organization. What is my return on my investment? What do I give? What is my input and what is my output? And I compare the ratio of my own outputs to my own inputs with that of other people. So when I think that I earn less than other professors at Goethe University, although I feel I'm more productive, then I find the system inequitable, and this leads to dissatisfaction. When I feel that I'm overpaid in relation to other people and in relation to what I invest, according to the theory, it also makes me feeling less good and dissatisfied. What do people do? Of course, it depends a little bit on the reward systems. So, for example, when people are paid by piece in accord, or when they are paid a fixed salary by the time they are working, typically it's 38 or 37 and a half hours per week in Germany. And when we feel over-rewarded and we are paid by time, we could produce more. So I'm paid a fixed, relatively fixed salary every month. And if I would feel that I'm doing less than other professors that earn the same salary, then I could try to become more productive, publish more papers, get more research money, and etc. If I would be paid by piece, so for example, when part of my salary is based on the number of publications that I produce, and I feel that I really earn a little too much compared to others for the number of publications that I publish, then I will produce fewer, but maybe of higher quality. And when I'm under-rewarded, I do the opposite. I could produce a large number of really mediocre publications and journals which accept everything they get sent to, because that will make me earn more money. If I'm produced by time, then I can produce less output or output of poorer quality. By and large, research has confirmed equity theory. However, the dissatisfaction that results from being over-rewarded is smaller than the dissatisfaction that results from being under-rewarded. So typically we can live with a little bit inequity when our outcomes are more positive than our inputs compared to other people's inputs and outcome ratio. We are easily unhappy and motivated to reduce this unhappiness by taking action when we feel that we are paid less than we think we deserve in relation to others. And equity theory was developed in the 1960s and 70s of the last century, but then it has been translated into research on organizational justice in general. And organizational justice was extending equity theory by saying it's not only about the outcome. It's not only about the reward that we get in relation to what we put into work. This is only one element of justice. This is called distributive justice. What is my outcome and do I find this fair or not? What is my pay in relation to others and am I happy or not with this fairness? This is one component of organizational justice, but only one. And the other two are equally important and are important moderators of the link between distributive justice and all sorts of outcomes, like satisfaction, intention to perform, intention to quit, absenteeism, etc. And the other two forms are first procedural justice. This is whether I perceive the process of attaining how much I'm rewarded or not as fair. So when we in our institute, for example, have a clear catalog of criteria for which departments are rewarded, publications, PhD titles, getting external funding, being editors of important journals, etc., and my outcome is relatively poor, so my distributive justice feeling is low because I receive less than other departments, I'm very unhappy and very dissatisfied when I think that the criteria are not the right ones, or when I think that someone has fiddled the criteria to make more output or to gain more outcome than is needed. If, however, I think, yeah, the criteria were agreed and I know the rules of the game and I've played the game and I've not ended up with the best outcome because others were better, but the system is still fair, then I can also accept less outcomes, less distributive justice. And the final component is interactional justice. This is the perceived degree to which one is treated with dignity and respect. Am I treated fairly by my supervisor? It's the most important component. But also, am I treated fairly by my colleagues or by the organization's top management or personnel department, etc.? How do I feel being treated here as a human person? So I can stand negative outcomes. I may also stand negative outcomes plus some feeling that the processes, the procedures are not entirely fair. As long as I have a supervisor who still treats me with dignity, when he or she, for example, brings me the message that I will not get a bonus this year, and I'm unhappy with it because I have expected the bonus, and I'm unhappy with it because I think, yeah, but it's unfair that the bonus is only determined in relation to research, and I'm such a great teacher. I can still stand this when my boss tells me, I know how you feel, and I'm also unhappy with the system, and let's do something together to change the system over time, etc. It's better than when he sends me an email. You don't get a bonus this year. Bad luck. Good luck for next year. Okay? And these three things can only be seen and work in combination. So most of the research of the last 15 years has shown that there are interaction effects. So typically we find all sorts of two- and three-way interactions. When distributive justice is low, it's okay when procedural justice and or interactional justice are high. Questions? Okay, another theory. Expectancy theory. Very simple. And I demonstrate this to you. If I would give you this. And then Oh, sometimes someone has written over my nice drawing. Do you see the target? Do you see the bullseye? Good. How motivated are you to try to throw the little pen's cap, and if you hit the bullseye, I may give you the balance of my credit card. It may be negative. The balance may be negative. If you hit the bullseye, what would be your motivation to try on a scale from 0 to 100? Oh, okay. What if you hit the bullseye? I will give you £20. How strong is your motivation to try now? 100%. Yeah, it should be like more like 80, okay? If you hit this, I will give you a euro. 5? That's easily earned money. Anyway. 100%. You will not make it anyway. You can try. The three elements of expectancy theory are the relationship between effort and performance, the relationship between performance and reward, and the link between the reward that is promised and our personal goal. So what's important to you? This was all about money now, but I could have also promised other things, like a free textbook or an extra hour with me. Yeah. Thank you. And some of these things are valued more and others are valued a little bit less. Like I said, over the whole lesson, according to Maslow, according to Hertzberg, according to other models, some people value money, some people value other money. But of course, for all of us, money is some incentive. And to know that I get £20 is of course better than to know that I will get £1 or €1. Now, when I value the outcome, this is the first thing that managers have to establish when they set goals and when they establish a reward scheme. What is the outcome that my employees can attain when they perform at the level that I as a manager would like them to attain? And when I only promise some money, then I'm making some people happy, but I probably made these people not happy, for which money is not the key issue, who already earn a little bit more and who have relatively simple living standards and who would really like to have a little bit more leisure time or get a more interesting job, etc. So this is the first thing that people should look at. Are the rewards that are promised the rewards that are valuable to the people that they lead? The second important thing is, will individual performance relate to getting the outcome or not? And when I said, I may give you some money, or it might be that you will earn a bonus, then of course people are less motivated than if they are absolutely sure that they will get it. So many organizations have bonus schemes that say, yeah, and the overall amount of money that we can put into the system is relatively fixed. So it's like £300,000 for 100 people, and it will not change for the next 2 or 3 years. Then you can exactly calculate how much of the overall pot you may get when you perceive at the expected level, and when you end up with 10 points and each point translates into €2,000 or whatever. However, when organizations say, yeah, this is the system and these are the criteria, but we have absolutely no idea how much overall money we can spend on bonuses next year. It will depend on the global industry, it will depend on general headquarters, it will depend on whatever. Then you feel, yeah, if I put in a lot of effort now, and if I will do what I'm expected to do, it may still be that I don't get anything for it. So I probably don't invest as much as I could. And the final link is, are my individual abilities and skills suited or fit to perform on the level that I'm expected to perform? When my supervisor tells me that I have to find 10 new customers and then I will get a bonus of 10% of my annual salary, then this may be important and high. This may be given and high and motivating. But when I really know that I'm not a good salesperson and that I have never been able to get more than 3 customers in any given period, then I'm not motivated because the first link between effort and performance is a relatively low relationship. Okay? Before I introduce the next theory, I have a little questionnaire for you. Sorry? It's very simple. I think it's 5 questions. Think about a job that you are currently doing next to your studies, or think about a job that you have been doing recently. If you have never done any work, then think about your studies. Think about your job as a student.
Nee, nee, ich nehme mir den jetzt weg. Ich will nicht den Euro abgeben.
Was haben Sie gesagt?
Ich fange die extra Stunde an mit Ihnen. Das war eine ernsthafte Frage, weil die Vorlesungszeit
ist. Ehrlich?
Ehrlich.
Ich habe aber noch so viel.
22.
Ich habe... motivating potential score and the related theory, just 2 minutes. I think the rest is also important. Okay, do you have a number? Does everyone have one number now? By adding the first 3 results and multiplying it by question 4 and question 5. Who has a number? Do you have a number?
Yeah.
Which number?
I have 34.
34 doesn't sound too much. What job are you doing or thinking of?
Yeah, I'm. Research is so, yeah.
Okay. What is the lowest number of the 5 dimensions?
I think it's 2. And it's odd
Okay, thank you. Who has a score higher than 34? Yes, please. What do you have? 110 and 210. So that's almost the maximum. Yeah. What? Okay, 60, that's twice as much as he has. What is your job or type of job you're thinking about?
It's a job as an office assistant, mm-hmm. but for a non-profit organization that organizes events with teachers, international teachers.
Okay, thank you. Frau Turkton. 88, the highest score so far. What type of job? Yeah. But you are working for a better professor who grants you more autonomy. So this was just a very short version of the Job Diagnostic Survey, the JDS. And together with Sebastian Steckmann and Nina Juncker, we are currently publishing a new version of it, the Work Diagnostic Questionnaire. The key is that if people think their job is variable and utilizes a variety of their skills, if they find that they produce one whole piece from the beginning to the end rather than being a small wheel somewhere in a big process, and if they think their job is significant, so as Dorian said, doing something for a non-profit organization for children is a job that is probably more significant than being a research assistant and entering data or making copies for lectures. Autonomy is very important because only when we have some leeway in how we do our job, we are responsible for the outcomes. When we have no autonomy, when we are exactly told what to do, when to do it, how to do it, then the people who tell us what to do are responsible and not we. And when we never get feedback from the job itself, whether we're doing the job well or less well, then we don't have knowledge of the results. And these three factors together lead to more motivation, higher satisfaction, etc. Employee growth needs strengths, whether people want to have autonomy and feedback and a good, meaningful job, moderates the relationship. Some people are really oriented, like McGregor's theory X, towards getting money. They don't have a high self-actualization, self-growth need, or a lower need than others. And for them, the model works less well. For most others, it works well, and it can be directly used to redesign jobs, to think about what can we do to increase autonomy, to provide feedback, how can I shift people around in terms of job rotation so that they get more job identity by seeing what happens to the things that they produce afterwards and before, or by job enrichment, increasing the degree to the worker controls planning, execution, and evaluation. I will stop here. I think you can read the slides for yourself. It's about putting it into practice, getting... thinking about different work arrangements and different reward systems like ownership plans, etc. Sorry for talking so much. Next week I will try to limit my own talk and attend more to the slides. Have a great week. Thank you.